This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Today, we start the show way, way back in 1948 when singer Nat King Cole put out a record called Nature Boy.
There was a boy, a very strange, enchanted boy. They say he wandered very far over land and sea.
The song was a huge number one hit. It sold a million copies just that year. Now, other artists took notice, and since then, hundreds of covers have been recorded by everyone from Frank Sinatra.
But very wise was he.
To John Coltrane, Miles Davis, Ella Fitzgerald, Bobby Darin.
A magic day he passed my way.
Caetano Veloso, Jose Feliciano.
So many things, fools and kings. This he said to me.
David Bowie.
The greatest thing you'll ever love.
Lady Gaga and Tony Bennett did it as a duet.
It's just to love and be loved in return.
But our story today is about the guy who wrote the song.
He's a student of Oriental mythology, a devout yogi, composer of the nation's number one song hit, Nature Boy. His name is Eden Abi.
His name was actually Eden Abez, Abi, to his friends. Or that's the name he took for himself after he arrived in Los Angeles in 1941. And Nature Boy was really a song about himself and others who were hippies, long before hippies existed. Brian Chittister is a creative historian who's working on a documentary about Eden Abez. Earlier this year, he released a new album of the composer's songs based on sheet music that he discovered at the Library of Congress. Hey, Brian.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm all right. And Joe Ramirsa is a musician and a producer who actually worked with Abez late in his life here in L.A. Hey, Joe.
Hey, Steve. How you doing, sir?
Good. We're doing well. Brian, I'm going to start with you. If you wouldn't mind telling us a little bit about Abez and his lifestyle. We mentioned he was a hippie before the hippies were cool, right? He was such an unusual character and spent a lot of time living outside, like, I guess, under the Hollywood sign?
That's right. When it was still actually the Hollywood land sign up until 1949, he lived outdoors with a loose band of brothers who called themselves the California Nature Boys in the 1930s and 40s and were interested in Eastern mysticism. They followed some gurus like Krishnamurti and Yogananda, who were in Southern California at that time giving lectures. They practiced alternative diets. They hung around a place called the Eutrophians, which there was one location downtown LA and one on Laurel Canyon Boulevard, and it was a raw foods cafe where the Nature Boys needed, you know, sun-dried bread and played piano and did dishes and made music. And so, you know, they were really the precursors of the hippies, but I would say that Abi was probably the most profound amongst them in terms of talent. And he developed Nature Boy and a lot of other songs while they were all living outdoors together. They also lived near Palm Springs in the caves above Palm Springs, actually in an area called Tockwitz Canyon. And that's probably where Abi developed the Nature Boy suite more than any other place that he lived outdoors. But you know, he was really somebody who was a seeker, somebody whose background was very mysterious. He cultivated this image of himself as kind of an Old Testament-looking prophet and somebody who had very, very unusual ideas for the Great Depression era and the post-war era in America, and really set the stage for, I think, you know, the counterculture that would emerge in the 1950s and 60s and change a lot of our impressions about the ecology and about peace and love and things of that nature.
He lived outside, was outside a lot, but he was also outside the mainstream in America. I mean, you mentioned, you know, raw foods and all these things that he was doing in the 30s and 40s and even into the, I mean, and for most of his life, by the way. Yet one of his songs gets recorded by this rising star, Nat King Cole, 1948. It becomes a big hit. And the two of them, I want to play this, the two of them appeared on a TV show together and explained how it all came to be.
One day I heard that King Cole and his trio were appearing at a theater in Los Angeles. So I came down from the hills and went to the theater.
You know, Dwight, Nature Boy almost wasn't published. You see, the doorman at the theater wouldn't let Abby backstage, so he placed Nature Boy in an envelope and asked the doorman to deliver it to me. Even in the excitement, I had forgotten to leave his address.
Well, what did you do, Nat?
Well, I started a search for the strange fellow who left this song with me, and I had to leave on a road tour before I found him.
Yes, and while Nat was traveling, one of his friends found me.
That's from the TV show We the People in 1948. Way before the internet. It was hard to find people back then. You couldn't just Google someone. The host, that interview you just heard, named Dwight Wiest, asked Abez what he'd do with all the money that he was making from that song.
All the money in the world will not change my way of life, because all the money in the world could not give me the things I already have. Anna and I have learned that nature and a simple life will bring you peace and happiness. We sleep on the ground in sleeping bags in the California mountains and deserts.
So Abez mentions his wife, Brian. Her name was Anna. They had a child together, a son, Zoma. Tell us a little bit about his family life. And actually, it's a pretty sad story, right?
Yeah, well, it becomes a sad story, and Joe knows something about this as well. But Abby was married to Anna in 1946. He claims that he met her downtown outside a cafe. She was actually sitting on a bus, and he had walked outside of a cafe, and according to legend, threw his number through the window. I don't know exactly what number he gave her or where she called him at. He was living in the backyard of the owners of the Eutrophians at the time in Silver Lake. And they got married in 1946. Zoma was born in October 1948, a few months after Nature Boy was a huge number one hit. And John and Vera Richter, who owned the Eutrophians and where they were staying, died a year later. So at that point, Abby and Anna and Zoma, they started, you know, kind of making their way around to different areas where they could live outdoors and live this very unusual alternative lifestyle. And so for a lot of the 1950s, they lived in Big Tujunga Canyon. They also lived at some ashrams up near the Glendale area, and there were other areas where they were known to camp out. But they literally did live outdoors together, and there are so many pictures of them. In late 1960, early 1961, Anna contracts bone cancer, and a few years later, she dies at the age of 44. After that, in the mid-1960s, Zoma was having problems with drugs and, you know, juvenile delinquency. And even though he was also apparently like a very brilliant person and somebody that Abby really spoke fondly of, he tragically died of an overdose in 1969 at the age of 21.
Joe Ramirsa, when you knew him later in life, did he talk about his family very much, or when he was living over in Tujunga?
Not too much. Our focus was mostly on the music and, you know, the poems that he was writing at that time. But what was interesting when listening to Brian talk, and he says, you know, the unusual lifestyle, you know, when you think about it, a natural lifestyle is the normal lifestyle. I mean, what we live in now, you know, with all the technology and conveniences around us, you know, we're so far removed from nature.
Yeah.
But, you know,
well,
to society,
he was described as Old Testament, right? He had the long hair. The Guardian described it as Jesus-length hair, which I thought was kind of funny, yeah. Brian, how did he deal with fame and money? I mean, the opportunity to get some of these royalties from this song, you know, he still maintained that off-the-grid lifestyle. How did the mainstream music industry deal with him?
At first, they were fascinated and treated him like a novelty. You know, those show that you have played the audio clip from had him on, and they were very fascinated with the way that he talked about money, the way that he talked about his lifestyle, the way that he talked about his creative aspect. But as time went on and he produced other materials with other crooners of the day, when they wouldn't become a hit, he became more and more of a punchline of the sort of you know, cynical media cycle where they looked at this guy and said, you know, look how unpragmatic he is. Look at how unpractical his life is. If you take that path in life, you too will be somebody who eats twigs and dirt. I mean, he did have some other hits. A song called Wine, Women, and Gold by the Modern Heirs was a hit in New York City in 1954. Sam Cooke's Lonely Island, written by Abi in 1957, went to number 20 on the Billboard New Cashbox charts.
I'm so lonely because I live on a lonely island in the heart of a city. I live on a lonely island. There isn't any hope for me. I tell you, my heart is broken. It's a shame and a pity. I might as well be shipwrecked in the middle of the sea. I live on,
you know, there wasn't the Grateful Dead and the Doors and Jimi Hendrix and Santana and you know, the other hippies that were around at that time that you could sort of compare him to. He was pretty much like an island in the 1950s. He really just kind of looked like an oddball, I think, to the media, and they very much treated him that way.
Nobody seems to care. How lonely can you be? I walk around the city, my heart sends out a flare.
Brian, Abez didn't just write songs, though, for other artists. He also, he recorded his own music, too, right?
Yeah, starting almost right away, he had a contract for the Nature Boy Orchestra in 1950 to do two singles for Mercury Records. After that, he recorded some solo material with a music impresario, an indie record label owner in Los Angeles named Bob Bertram throughout the 50s. And what happened was, at the end of the decade, Abi had signed a contract with Delphi Records, and that label ended up putting out Abi's one and only solo album, Eden's Island, in 1960.
Let's hear a song, a track from that Eden's Island album called Full Moon.
To live in an old shack by the sea, and breathe the sweet salt air. To live with the dawn and the dusk, the new moon and the full moon.
Joe Ramirsa, I'm going to bring you back in. You're a musician, you're a composer, but you also engineer and you produce, and it was in that capacity that you worked with Abez late in his life. What was that like? What was he like later in life? Was he still the crunchy granola type who wanted to live in the woods?
Well, when I was working with him, we're talking about a man in his 80s, in the 80s. Right. So when I worked with him in the 80s, you know, the technology had come around, you know, people are starting to use computers, and it was just overwhelming to him, the technology. You know, he's a gentle man and just peaceful person, but, you know, things of technology would frustrate him, you know. He didn't want to be in the public eye. When I met him, he didn't want anything to do with the public. You know, he was very secretive and very private. He was worried about people stealing his music and his words and his thoughts.
Was it hard, Joe, to schedule time to work with him if he didn't have, you know, a place and didn't have, you know, maybe he didn't have a phone or you really couldn't connect with him easily?
Yeah, there was no cell phones at that time, and he didn't have a phone I could call him or keep in touch with. You know, I was working a lot back then on several projects, and when he came to town, he'd leave a message on my machine saying, Joe, I'm in town, I need to get together with you, let's fix that thing from last time, you know. And I've got all those recordings too of him on my phone machine, and they're just lovely to listen to.
The first thing I would say to the youth of America is, and I could raise enough money to put it on a billboard around town now. It would say, the earth is my altar, the sky is my dome, the mind is my garden, and the heart is my home. And I'm always at home. Yay, I'm always at home.
Come and live the enchanted life, where time becomes eternity, and you will become a dreamer, and dream untellable dreams.
Brian Chittister, a little over a decade ago, you discovered a whole bunch of sheet music that Abez had written that had been archived at the Library of Congress. This was music that had never been recorded before, right?
Right. So after the Eden's Island album was released, it ended up flopping. It sold about 100 copies. And I think that, combined with the fact that his wife had contracted bone cancer in the same year, in 1960, made it so that it was really impossible for him to follow up Eden's Island in the time. And that was always a big burning question for me for the first 10 or so years that I was researching Abby's music and his life. What did he do after Eden's Island? I felt that it was such an incredible musical statement, so cohesive and so ahead of its time, that it always just sort of puzzled me that he wouldn't have followed it up. So when I went to the Library of Congress and I went through their copyright records of what Abby had written and submitted, I found that there was 22 tracks that he wrote between the fall of 1960 and the summer of 1963 when Anna passed away. And it just was a fascinating body of music, and I thought, you know, I would love to develop this at some point. And at first I did with my flute teacher and with some musical friends of mine who were able to demo some of the pieces. But in 2018, I was introduced by my friend Dominic Briori to Ixtehuele, and they and their label agreed to undertake the project with myself and Johan Jarmelsen, who is the leader of the band, producing.
And earlier this year, you released an album of some of that music called Dharmaland.
That's correct. Yes, in June.
So the music from Dharmaland, Brian, was interpreted, performed by the Swedish band Ixtehuele. And I'm thinking, Swedish band, Library of Congress, you know, flautist, you know, like, and this guy who wrote music back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, who was living in Tahunga somewhere. How does all of this converge?
I know, it's kind of an unbelievable story, but the truth of the matter is that Joe will tell you, Abby planted these seeds that were incredibly prescient and unusual, and they continue to sprout in almost the most unpredictable ways. We also had access to Abby's handmade drums. We got access right at the last second to one of his hand-carved bamboo flutes. We had 9 of his friends and former collaborators guest on the album. So I, you know, in some ways I can't quite explain it, but I pinch myself every day that it's out and it turned out as beautifully as it did. I'm, you know, so proud of it.
Joe, you engineered the album Dharmaland. What was the experience like for you working on, you know, this guy that you knew toward the end of his life and all the music that he created, that he wrote way before that?
Right. It's interesting working for a guy even after he's gone, you know? So I'm still engineering for him. Couple emotional times, you know, for me, you know, behind the mic when I was singing one of his songs, Fire of the Soul.
That was the highlight of the album.
The chemistry was good. You know, the personalities, everybody was working together and with the purpose of making Abby's music alive again, you know. So I had a great time working on that record.
He died in 1995, the result of a car crash here in Southern California. So he's been gone 25, 26 years now. What do people take from his life, from his music? Brian, you've been researching Abez's life for a long time. How long?
26 years since I was 18.
So right about the time he died.
I found out about him maybe 2 months before he died. And I was immediately blown away by the Eden's Island album and by Nature Boy, which was the only thing that was really known at that time of his. And Abi became almost like my teacher or my guru. Through his music, I was introduced to so many other things of a cultural and spiritual and lifestyle nature. The society, as Joe was talking about, the abnormality that we've sort of normalized via technology and the rat race and materialism has become increasingly difficult to abide for a lot of people. That doesn't make sense to them anymore. And I think, you know, Abi seems in some ways more relevant now than he was then. And I think, you know, for me, that's unequivocally true. I didn't have a sense of direction. And I think Abi's depth and his practicality has really spoken to me, and I've tried to reproduce that or make sure that that's deeply embedded in all the things that I put out that have to do with him, whether it's articles or album projects or my documentary.
Brian Chittister, a creative historian working on a documentary, as I mentioned, about Eden Abes. The new album of music that he helped bring to life is called Dharma Land. Joe Remersa, who worked with Eden Abes and engineered that new album, I want to thank you both.
Thank you, Steve, for interest in Abi. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you so much, Steve.
You got to throw the pleasure of the senses in the fire of the soul. You got to throw the pleasure of the senses in the fire of the soul. If you want peace, brother, peace,
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Moving on now with Greater LA on KCRW. Steve Chiotakis here. The next time you make dinner reservations, you might also want to look up the eatery's COVID requirements. All across Southern California, restaurants are doubling down on COVID protections. The city of West Hollywood is already requiring you to show proof of vaccination in order to enter indoor spaces, with the city of LA soon to follow. Palm Springs requires either proof of vaccination or a negative COVID test. In other words, some mandates are more rigid than others, depending upon where you are, and that's probably leaving you confused. Our resident food and dining expert, Mona Holmes from Eater LA, is here to help you map out your next dinner date. Hey, Mona.
Hi, Steve.
I want to start with the strictest dining mandates so far. Where do you need to show proof of vaccination to grab a bite to eat?
The strictest one, I would absolutely say, is in West Hollywood. We talked about this previously. You know, they jumped on this around August to draft a formal vaccine mandate response, and it became official last month. But pretty much, if you want to eat in an indoor area, or as they're calling it in the ordinance, a covered area of a restaurant, cafe, bar, you'll have to show proof of at least one vaccination dose before entering an indoor area. And by November 4th, you're going to have to show full-on vaccination. So double shots or, of course, the single J&J shot. In other parts of the city, you're going to notice that in some cases you can present a negative COVID test, but in West Hollywood, they're not allowing that at all. This also applies to employees. So they are going to have to be fully vaccinated by November 4th.
Fully vaccinated to eat inside. But if there is an outdoor patio area, can you do that if you're not vaccinated?
They can 100% go into the patio area. They can also use the bathroom, is what officials have told me. It's just that they can't spend or linger for any prolonged time within those establishments.
Are there any places, Mona, that seem to be taking, you know, the opposite approach, maybe steering clear of vaccine mandates?
There have been a couple of spottings I've noticed on social media where some people have put up some video or photos of people walking in without having their vaccination status checked. But for the most part, I found that the restaurants that I spoke to want to stick to this. They want to make sure that they're looking out for their, not only just for their customers, but also their employees who work there.
And it can be really confusing, right? Like, who's checking those things?
Yeah, it's pretty much landing on the restaurant owners and staff to check vaccination status whenever anyone comes in. I did speak with one restaurant owner who was hiring someone almost like a security guard to navigate that, because they don't want to put their staff in the position of being a healthcare worker, which is what this one restaurant owner described. You know, they just don't really want to have any kind of backlash or abuse. I mean, I think we've all seen that video that happened out of New York where that one hostess was asking for vaccination status and wound up getting beat up by the people who didn't want to comply.
Yeah. It's a lot, but also, like in Palm Springs, you have to show a negative COVID test. Mm-hmm. You know, it's either or. Where else in Southern California besides, I mean, that's the desert, Palm Springs, what other cities require either the vaccination or a negative COVID test?
Pasadena, who has its own health department that's separate from the county of Los Angeles, they also require customers receiving service indoors. They have to provide proof of the first dose by October 7th, which was last week, and the same deadlines, October 7th and November 4th. Those are things to remember by everyone, because this is going to impact how you dine out. And then there's the city of LA. Just last week, the city council approved an ordinance. And that is very similar. You know, you have to have the same proof, you know, and it's not just restaurants. And of course, it's what I cover, but it's also bars, gyms, spas, concert venues, movie theaters, retail establishments. You're going to have to show that proof before you go indoors. Everything will be changing considerably in, you know, just a little bit over 3 weeks to make sure that the region, not just Los Angeles, not just Pasadena or West Hollywood, but the region can battle against the Delta variant and make sure that people are going to stay safe.
Especially with winter coming up, which we saw last year was just horrendous. There are so many ways, Mona, that you can prove that you're vaccinated or that you got a negative COVID test, right? I mean, it's pretty easy.
Correct. In very rare cases, will you be able to get around this? But let's talk about what you need to present in different parts of the city. So the acceptable proof is a CDC vaccination card, and that's the paper copy that you got when you got your shots. And it has to show the date it was administered. You know, that's the official one. But you can also have a photocopy or a copy on your phone of the same card. You can also have a proof of vaccination from a healthcare provider. You can also have a digital COVID-19 vaccine record that was issued by the state of California, or any kind of documentation issued by another state or a foreign governmental jurisdiction or by a private company. Any one of those are completely acceptable.
And of course, the negative test that you get from a testing site, you can also prove that way as well.
Unless you're in West Hollywood, a negative test from the last couple of days will not fly there.
And the same thing in the city of LA when it goes into effect.
Yeah. It's a lot.
Mona Holmes, reporter at Eater LA, a regular here on Greater LA. Mona, as always, nice to hear your voice.
Thank you so much.
That's going to do it for us this evening. Tomorrow, students are back in school, primary and college, and yet the pandemic's still weighing heavily. And the need for services outstrips demand in spite of new state funding because so many positions are still open. That's tomorrow on a new episode of Greater LA. All new episodes of the website, by the way, kcrw.com/GLA. Subscribe to the podcast, get it on the regular. Tell us how you're doing, kcrw.com/GLA. Catherine Barnes, Jackie Sedley, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Lorenzo Ponce de Leon, Mario Saavedra, Amy Ta, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all made the show happen tonight. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Have a great night.